and running in my nightgown across the lawn to their house. I recalled the grass beneath my bare feet, the strangeness of being outside all by myself in my nightclothes. The entirety of my childhood formed around the memory, and I felt a sudden, cavernous emptiness. The next day I stopped your mother to tell her what had happened. She was always leaving, going to the city, parade of babysitters. I told her you had been frightened. She needed to be home more, or at least hire someone more caring. She screamed at me, furious. How dare I tell her how to raise her child? I did everything I could to flee my parents. It pains me to write these words. They were all I knew of the world. And yet, I walked that poor dog up and down those unfortunately named suburban streets in search of a family who would open their door and take me in. I now wonder what those people thought, whether they were curious about why I was always circling their block, pausing by their front walks, why I always seemed to be hanging around. Once invited in, I ate cookies at their kitchen tables, watched television in their dens, drank soda on their porches, quietly desperate to belong to what seemed a warm, enchanted circle. Eventually, the sky would begin to darken, and it would be time for me to go home. I'd let myself in through the back door and make my way upstairs to my room. There was no one to ask me why I had been gone so long or where I had been. The antiseptic silence was suffocating in contrast to the messy, noisy world outside. By the time night fell, either my mother would have returned from whatever she did during the day, or a babysitter would make me dinner to my mother's specifications. Later, the garage door would open, my father returning from his job in the city. That was the sound I waited for, the electronic rumble of my father returning, then the brief bear hug that seemed to contain within it his warm and beautiful heart. I was afraid of my mother and wanted very little to do with her. She was not the locus of my longing. It wasn't another mother I was after when I went from house to house like a stray kitten. It wasn't siblings either. I was a girl in search of a father, not because I didn't love my father, but because my love couldn't save him. That younger man on the train to Philadelphia had become a middle-aged man crushed by an accumulation of secrets, losses, and the unsaid. My father was already gone. Chapter 30. Before summer came to an end, I forced myself to fly to Chicago to see my father's sister, Shirley. It was not a trip I wanted to make. In all the exploration I had done thus far, my conversation with my mother's best friend, Charlotte, my visit to Rabbi Lookstein, nothing had terrified me as much as coming face to face with my beloved aunt. At first, I thought I'd never tell her, that at the age of 93, this was something she didn't need to know. But Michael had pushed me. Shirley might know something, he'd said. And he had a point. She and my father had been very close. If he had confided in anyone, that is, if he'd had anything to confide, it might have been her. I was alone in the backseat of a town car on the outskirts of Chicago, searching for signs of Jewish life. It felt like we had been driving for hours, though it had been no more than 40 minutes. Strip malls gave way to the flat grid of a suburban neighborhood. The driver turned on Golda Meir Boulevard. I spied a kosher butcher, a yeshiva, a lone chassid in a long black coat and black hat, walking down a side street lined with ranch houses and split levels. When Jacob and I had visited the year before, we had arrived in the dark. Through the tinted window, I saw a woman wearing a wig, holding the hand of a small boy with payas. I knew that Shirley's house must be close. As I neared her home, I fought an overpowering urge to ask my driver to turn around and head back to the airport. In the years after my father's death, Shirley and I had grown increasingly connected. We spoke by phone often, and many times she had told me that she'd promised my father she'd look out for me. Though Shirley was my father's younger sister, She had always been his protector, and he had turned to her in times of emotional peril. It was she he had called when he learned that his young fiancée was terminally ill. It was she to whom he had confessed in later years his unhappiness in his marriage to my mother. During the time that my father and mother struggled to have a baby, he might have unburdened himself to Shirley. I was back to the same lurching, destabilizing fear that came over me each time I was about to speak with anyone who might, in an instant, illuminate the extent of my parents' actions and awareness. Just as when I had spoken with Charlotte and Rabbi Lookstein, the possibility existed that I would discover with absolute certainty that my parents had colluded to keep my identity a secret from me. Wendy Kramer had summarily dismissed my belief that my parents hadn't known, or at the very least, that my mother hadn't known. "Which story would ease your heart?" Lookstein had asked me. "The true one," I had answered. But at any moment, the truth could flatten me. On the flight to Chicago, I went over some correspondence I'd had with the author of a dissertation on the history of fertility. "As for records, most clinics purposefully destroyed them," she wrote. I stared at the word destroyed, willing the letters to rearrange themselves. I still held out the hope that a dusty file cabinet in the basement archives of Penn or in the attic of one of Edmund Farris's three children would contain notes, signatures, evidence. In holding with psychological theories of the time, men were usually told to forget the procedure had ever happened if they used a donor. Could my father, could any father, have forgotten that the procedure had ever happened? My car pulled away and I walked up the front steps to my cousin Joanne's home, where Shirley now lived. Another car would pick me up in 4 hours. 4 hours in which I would tell my aunt, who had once described herself to me as a weaver's daughter, that she and I were not threads in the same tapestry, that we were not related by blood, that her much-adored older brother was not my father. Joanne opened the door and ushered me inside warmly. I was still holding a Starbucks cup from the airport. Was Starbucks kosher enough? I wasn't sure. "Is this okay?" I gestured to the cup. If it wasn't, she didn't embarrass me. "Of course. Mom's been expecting you." Joanne led me into a sitting room. There, in the corner, was a framed photograph of Joseph Soloveitchik, the same rabbi whose portrait graced Lookstein's office at Ramaz. A desk was surrounded by bookcases filled with leather-bound Hebrew volumes. On several long, polished tables, just as had been the case in Shirley's home near Boston and in my grandmother's apartment in New York City, there were literally hundreds of family photographs. Perhaps as the eldest daughter, Joanne had inherited them. Being a part of this vast array had always comforted me, even as it had confused me. I was the lone, pale, blonde child in the sea of dark-haired, dark-eyed grandchildren and great-grandchildren, my otherness and difference glaringly evident. Yet I had never had any doubt that I was part of the chain that reached back and back through the generations, unbroken. As I stood in my cousin Joanne's sitting room, now knowing better, it felt as if the links of that chain were in pieces on the floor all around me. Shirley emerged from her living quarters behind the sitting room, and we held each other close. She wore a dark skirt and a gray silk blouse, her silver hair pulled back into a low bun. She was unadorned, no makeup, no necklace, no earrings. Her plain gold wedding ring, the only decoration on her elegant, supple hands. A Juilliard-trained pianist, she had still been able to sit at the keyboard and play Brahms ballades well into her 80s. She had become smaller with each passing year. As I hugged her, the top of her head rested beneath my chin. "Come into my room, sweetheart, before we sit down. There's something I want to show you." I followed Shirley into her bedroom. She had managed to distill the contents of her 7-bedroom home near Boston into a simple, almost monastic space that still contained the essence of her life. Black and white portraits of her 4 children were arranged on a wall opposite her small, well-made bed. A photograph of her late husband, my Uncle Mo, was crowded onto a bookshelf, along with those of her 2 brothers, my dad and Uncle Harvey. All of them gone. She was the last of her generation. A pair of ancient baby shoes sat atop a pile of Shakespeare plays. All of my books, 5 novels, 3 memoirs, were nestled among volumes of Judaica. My heart quickened as I had the devastating thought, would she keep my books on her bookshelf once she knew the truth? Would it matter to her? Would she somehow blame me for not being her brother's daughter? A laminated newspaper clipping from an advice column, old and yellowed, hung on the wall near the bedroom door. It seemed so out of place amid the religious artifacts in Shirley's room, in a place of prominence where she would see it each day as she left her living quarters. Q. You mentioned the poem James Garner recites in the Chevy Tahoe ad. Is it by E.E. Cummings? Fred Good, Mount Dora, Florida. A. Nobody Knows It But Me is by ad copywriter Patrick O'Leary. Many readers asked for the text. Here it is. There's a place I travel when I want to roam, and nobody knows it but me. The roads don't go there and the signs stay home, and nobody knows it but me. It's far, far away and way, way afar. It's over the moon and the sea. And wherever you're going, that's wherever you are. And nobody knows it but me. As Shirley rummaged through her desk drawers, I examined this unlikely bit of ad copy. Later, I would think about what the poem meant to Shirley. It was something apart and aside from her daily prayers. Something that was hers and hers alone, that seemed to go to the core of her spiritual life. I had it right here, she said, closing one drawer and opening another, an envelope. It occurred to me that maybe she was nervous. After all, I had called a few weeks earlier to say I had something important to discuss with her and asked if I could pay a visit. She might have wondered why I was making the sudden day trip to Chicago. Or she might have suspected the reason. Either way, she would have been apprehensive. I wanted to give you... Don't worry, Cheryl. Wait, here it is. I opened a small plain envelope and pulled out 3 photographs. One was of Jacob and me, taken on the beach in Cape Cod when he was a toddler. In the golden light and salty air, we look as alike as we ever will, our hair wild and wavy, eyes the same blue as the sea. I had sent it to Shirley years ago. Why was she returning it to me? I had the awful feeling that perhaps she really did know, and she was returning my own son to me, disclaiming him as part of the family. I shoved the thought away as hard as I could. And not for the first time, I wished that I had taken Michael up on his offer to accompany me on this trip. The second 2 photographs were of my grandparents. I wanted you to have these of Grammy and Grandpa, Shirley said. They were at the height of their ascendancy. Height of their ascendancy. Who spoke in such a manner? And yet, coming from my aunt, it didn't sound odd, but rather like a humble statement of fact. It was no wonder I had mythologized my grandparents all my life. They were the stuff of myth. Shirley and I settled on the sofa in the sitting room. I wonder if you know why I'm here, I began. She shook her head no. I have a story to tell you, and I'm afraid you're going to find it painful, I continued. Shirley was so small, her back erect, as she readied herself to hear whatever it was I had come to say. Joanne must have gone out. The house was dead quiet. So quiet, I heard a clock somewhere, ticking, ticking. Was there any part of her that had always wondered if this day of reckoning would come? I began at the beginning. I told her I'd had my DNA tested. I looked for a flicker of awareness, a sense that she knew where this was going. I saw none. For the first time in my life, I understood the expression, blow by blow. At the mention of an unfamiliar first cousin, a ripple crossed her forehead, but nothing more. I began to explain about calling Susie and asking for her DNA sample. Do you need me to slow down? I asked a couple of times. Is there anything you don't understand so far? I asked this not because I thought she had the slightest cognitive decline. She had one of the sharpest minds of anyone I knew. But she was 93. When she was born, automobiles were relatively new. Televisions did not exist. She was already the mother of four when Watson and Crick discovered the chemical structure of DNA. Another elderly person to whom I have recounted the story had asked, "So you're saying you're part your father and part someone else?" Shirley grew ever more still as I spoke. She reminded me of a tiny animal in the forest, big eyes, big ears, quivering with attention. I told her that the comparison of DNA samples revealed that Susie and I were not related by blood. We were not half-sisters. She didn't move. And then, "Shirl, did you know that my parents had a hard time conceiving me?" "No, I didn't," she responded. There it was, my answer. She hadn't known. If my father had kept a secret, he'd kept it from his sister as well. I went on to tell her about Philadelphia, the Institute, my father's mad dashes from New York. As I spoke, a transcendent calm came over me. Some part of me broke off from the rest and marveled at this calm. "So you're saying, Dad isn't my biological father," I said. Five words, and a lifetime. Her eyes were locked onto mine. I was afraid she was going to stop breathing. Not a blink, not a sound. I feared it was as if I had said to her, "You're not mine. I'm not yours. We don't belong to each other." It felt violent. The world around us fell away. She leaned slightly forward, reached out, and grabbed my hand. "I'm not giving you up," she said. The thin shell holding me together cracked, and suddenly I was weeping with my whole body. "And you'd better not be giving me up," she said. Every syllable deliberate. "I'm not giving you up, Shirl," I sobbed. I was so afraid that "I have fewer years ahead of me than behind me," she said. "And you are my brother's daughter." As the hours blurred together, coffee, bagels, lox, tea, Shirley entered with me into the thicket of what might have happened. I brought up the question of halacha, and she treated it as if it were completely beside the point, in the same way Rabbi Lookstein had. The two most religious people I'd consulted seemed willing to throw out the rulebook in this matter. She listened carefully as I shared Lookstein's opinion with her. "It would have been within your father's character," she said slowly. "Very much in Paul's genre." I repeated what Lookstein said about my dad and the choices he made back in 1953 when his young fiancée was dying. "Your father was a hero." "I think there was great nobility in what Paul did at that time," Shirley said. "The Lubavitcher Rebbe offered him a very easy moral out, to keep postponing the wedding until Dorothy died. When you're offered an easy moral out and you don't take it, that's malchus, meaning kingly. Grammy and Grandpa at the height of their ascendancy. Great nobility." My eyes had not stopped stinging with tears. "Shirl, are you surprised that my father never said anything to you about their struggle with infertility?" "Not at all," she said. "He would have felt private about it. That's something that would have been in the deepest interior of their marriage. He would have been protective of your mother." A lifelong animosity had existed between Shirley and my mother. Shirley had described their relationship to me rather gently as being on different wavelengths, as if there was electric circuitry buzzing in the wires between us. I recall hearing my mother's raised voice, the slamming down of a phone. But when I brought up the possibility that my mother had deceived my father, that he never knew, Shirley didn't go there with me. She preferred the version of the story that I found most painful, that my father knew all along. "You're not an accident of history, Danny," Shirley said. Her eyes were brimming. "Not as far as I'm concerned, and not as far as the world is concerned. This isn't about the cold scientific facts. I have to tell you, in every way, and I'm not saying it to make you feel good, and I'm taking a chance saying it because you'll think I'm making it up. But between you and Paul, there was paternity, ownership, kinship. She trained her whole 93-year-old self, every cell in her being, in the direction of consoling me. Every bit of energy. It was the purest manifestation of love I had ever experienced. Knowing what you know, you're more of a daughter to Paul than you can possibly imagine. You take something that isn't your own, and you breathe life into it. You create it, and it becomes your creation. You are an agent to help my brother express the finest kind of love. Her hand rested on top of mine. It's rare that you get an opportunity in life to stand outside yourself. It's as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, "Child, come sit next to me, and now look." Finding all this out is a door to discovering what a father really is. It isn't closure. You may not get to have that, but it's an opening to a whole new vista. For the first time since that evening in June, when I'd stared uncomprehendingly into my computer screen, I felt a sense of peace. At least for the moment, the constant ache was gone. "You have to judge things by the result," Shirley continued. "And the result, in which you can exult, is that the very best was combined in you. Grace, brains, creativity, beauty. Whatever alien, mechanical, outside element was in the story, it was a story of success. You have such a rich endowment. You have been so recompensed. You carry the heightened sensitivity, to be sure. You carry the pain, and you also carry the reward." Her voice, hoarse from speaking for hours, was a part of me. Her strong hands, her expressive forehead, her sweet smile, all a part of me, because she had always been a part of me. I had been so afraid that blood would be all that mattered. Oh, how I had underestimated my remarkable aunt. My car was waiting at the curb. She had hardly paused all afternoon. Her eyes had never left mine. Words had coursed through her as if channeled from the very God she believed in, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. She was telling me that she was still my aunt, that my father was still my father. My whole lost family encircled us as we sat in the fading light of her kitchen in Chicago. "Sweetheart, this opens up a world of inclusiveness, and in the end, you have to include yourself. You aren't bleeding color. You're holding the light ones and the dark ones. They're all yours." Ultimately, in all of this, Danny, the postscript is that it's really called love. Part 3. Chapter 31. Shirley had used certain words to describe Ben Walden. Alien, mechanical, outside element, cold scientific facts. But Ben didn't feel like an outside element to me. Quite the opposite. He was very much an inside element. It wasn't just a physical resemblance. The man I watched on that YouTube video spoke in a cadence similar to mine, moved his hands in the same way, as if clearing space for his words when making a point. Donating sperm was not the same as, say, donating a kidney or a retina. It was the passing along of an essence that was inseparable from personhood itself. I had told Shirley nothing about discovering Ben. She didn't need to know that there was a retired doctor who lived in Portland, an actual human being with a face and a name, who was my biological father. Knowing what you know, you're more of a daughter to Paul than you can possibly imagine. I longed to believe this, even though I couldn't yet understand it. My father and I had shared a history, a culture, a landscape, a home, a language, an entire world. Our bond was real and unbreakable. But I also now knew, in the starkest terms, what had been missing. Mutual recognition. I did not come from him. I had never once looked into his face and seen my own. Weeks passed as I waited, hoping for a response from Ben, who had asked for time to thoughtfully process my request. With each email exchange, I braced for the possibility that he might stop writing back. He could drop out of sight, and there would be absolutely nothing I could do about it. Ben was the only person involved in my conception who was still living. My new reality continued to be ungraspable to me, and I was constantly aware of Ben's very aliveness, his existence on the other side of the country as he walked through his days, a person in the world. I latched onto facts. It was a fact that I had been conceived by artificial insemination. It was a fact that my father wasn't my biological father. It was a fact that Adam Thomas was my first cousin. It was a fact that Ben was Adam Thomas's uncle. That he had been a young medical student at the University of Pennsylvania, where he had donated sperm. I ran through these facts as I tried to fall asleep each night, as if recounting them might help me make more sense of things. But what I was really doing was unspooling a narrative 54 years long, and perhaps meeting Ben would help me find my footing and to begin again at the beginning. As late summer's golden light fell across our meadow out back, I allowed myself to get caught up in fantasies of meeting Ben. I pictured a cool, crisp afternoon in Portland, a city that was a blank slate for me. I conjured up a cafe of Ben's choosing. Perhaps we would sit outside at a small table. It would be a one-time meeting, so I told myself, and that would be just fine. We would make polite small talk, or we would speak of delicate matters. Maybe he'd tell me about the Farris Institute, or maybe we'd stick with safer subjects. Try as I might, I couldn't imagine what it would feel like to see myself in a stranger. I wondered if he would, in fact, feel like a stranger. Michael asked me more than once what I hoped to get out of meeting Ben. I didn't know. I just knew that it felt urgent and necessary. The books and printouts of articles and studies from scholarly journals and doctoral dissertations continued to pile up on my office floor near my desk. They shared the same small space decorated with the portrait of my grandmother, along with an entire crowd of framed family photos atop a standing bookcase. Each day, I entered my office in a state of even deeper dread. The pile of paper grew as my ability to tackle it diminished. I would begin reading an essay on, say, the legal history of donor insemination, and would find myself stricken, slightly ill, confused, enraged. I came across a Time cover story from 1945, Artificial Bastards, in which a judge ultimately ruled that artificial insemination is not adultery and therefore not grounds for divorce. How had this become my story? Or rather, how had it been my story all along? When I took a break from reading, I found it easier to search for more information about Ben on the internet. Haunted by the eerie awareness that I was stalking, I scrolled through his blog on medical ethics, found bits and pieces of news about him and his family. He had been married for 50 years. His wife was a Brazilian nurse whom he had met in the Peace Corps just after medical school. I learned more about their three children, a girl and two boys. The girl, my half-sister, was only 6 years younger than me. I watched YouTube videos of the Walden family at Christmas. A twinkling tree laden with ornaments dominated one corner of a living room. Tartan plaid placemats covered a holiday table. Teenagers ducked away from the camera. Little kids played underfoot. Grandparents sang a shaky duet that may have been a hymn. They were as foreign from my ancestors in the shtetl as could be. And yet they were, in the strictest definition of the word, my ancestors. Who were these people? What did this family have to do with me? Once again, I became that child, standing outside the warmly lit houses of my neighbors, alone in the fading dusk, longing to be invited inside. Early one Saturday evening, Michael and I were sitting in our library, about to head out to meet friends for dinner, when Ben Walden's name appeared in my inbox. As had been the case since the first time he wrote to me, the name, a name that would have meant nothing to me less than 2 months prior, filled me with a potent mixture of dread and excitement. I opened his email and saw that it was longer than the others. My voice shook as I began to read aloud to Michael. To Danny Shapiro from Benjamin Walden. Ray, 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 important letter. Dear Danny, I truly appreciate your emails about respecting my family's privacy, and I certainly take you at your word when you wrote, I would never expose you or your family in my work. I may someday write about my experience, but I will never name or identify you or your family. You have my word. That is not the kind of writer or person I am. I think I can understand and empathize with your desire to further connect face-to-face and to have further genetic confirmation of our link. I can only imagine how you feel, since I've never been there myself. A sense of our genetic link is important to most of us. When I donated sperm as a 22-year-old medical student, I was promised privacy and anonymity by the Fertility Institute, so I, along with many medical student friends, became donors for a period of time. The thought of some future contacts from the children conceived by artificial insemination never crossed my mind, so this has been an unusual and surprising situation that I've given a lot of thought to. I've looked through your website and read some of your writings. You are a remarkably talented writer and appear fortunate to be having such a successful career and family life. I'm happy for you in that you appear to be on a path to continued success, which I hope brings you great personal happiness. Danny, you have been able to see me from videos on my blog and to read my blog posts. These have been bits and pieces of the biographical information I'm willing to share. Likewise, I have been able to see videos of you and to read some of your writings, so I feel I have at least some glimpse of your life. At this point in my life, I don't have the time, energy, or interest to pursue this further. So, Danny, I don't intend to have genetic testing done or to have a meeting with you. I'm so sorry that this may sound harsh and uncaring, but I can't think of a better way to put it. I have reached this decision after discussion with my family and a few others. Please believe me, I empathize with your quest to understand your genetic history, but this is going to be my final communication with you. I wish you nothing but the best as your life moves forward with your family and your writing. Best regards, Ben. Chapter 32. I stared at the last paragraph of Ben's letter. Final communication. I'm so sorry that this may sound harsh. I closed my laptop and sat there, trembling. He can't just do that, Michael said. But of course he could. Ben Walden could do whatever he wished. His moral high ground, the guarantee of anonymity given by a long-defunct fertility institute and the dead scientist who ran it. Promised privacy, many medical school friends, period of time. I didn't even need to refer to the letter. I had memorized it as I read it. He's scared, Michael went on. And this did seem possible. The tone of this letter was different from Ben's communication in the past. The repetition of my name, almost like a plea. Leave me alone. Don't hurt me. Don't come after my family. The quoting back to me of my own words about respecting his privacy, as if I might have forgotten them. The strange appeasement of his flattery, as if his praise of me as a writer might serve as some sort of consolation prize. And finally, the slammed door, quickly, almost in haste, as if he'd better act fast before he changed his mind. I got up and poured myself a glass of wine. I had been drinking more than usual since late June, drinking differently, medicinally, blunting the internal blows. I took a deep breath and surveyed the room around me, trying to remember that I had a life that had been going on long before I knew about Ben Walden, a life in which the man in the yarmulke on the bookshelf was my one and only dad, a life in which the boy at his bar mitzvah was wrapped in the enormous tallis of his grandfather, fastened by his great-grandfather's filigreed tallis clips, a life of roots and certainty. At first, my fingers itched to respond. I'm disappointed, or how dare you, or I hope you'll reconsider. But instead of the wild, reckless abandon that had inspired my first communication with Ben, I now felt a calculating, merciless fury. I placed my laptop on the coffee table on top of a family photo album. I'm not writing back to him, I told Michael. I wanted Ben's own words to echo in his ears, and I believed they might, even though I didn't know him, even though he was a perfect stranger. He had shown himself to be a reflective person in each of our communications. And yet, the thought of some future contacts from the children conceived by artificial insemination never crossed my mind. In the 50-plus years since he had been that young medical student, his brief stint as a sperm donor had not haunted him. He hadn't lain awake a single night wondering about the unknown children he might have fathered. Even when DNA testing became available, and later, when it became inexpensive and simple, the possibility of being sought out had never occurred to him. But he was someone who spent his life thinking about medical ethics. And ultimately, this was an ethical question, if there ever was one. What did I owe him? What did he owe me? Who were we to each other? Michael and I left home and drove to our friend's place on a nearby lake. It was too late to cancel, and besides, what else was there to do? I seethed with a sense of futility and powerlessness. What if Ben really was resolved to keep the door between us slammed closed? I was an unpleasant after-effect of an action so inconsequential to him that it didn't even bear recalling. A bit of space debris, the flotsam and jetsam resulting from a meaningless young person's choice. "Maybe this is it," I said to Michael as we drove the winding country roads, the pretty landscape in stark contrast to the darkness inside me. "Maybe there won't be anything more to learn. Not about my parents, not about Ben." "That's not what's going to happen," Michael responded. "No way." "How do you know?" "Too much has been set in motion. If nothing else, you know there are more half-siblings out there." Indeed, the likelihood of this was high, very high. Ben had donated for a period of time. At that very moment, they were probably half-siblings of mine going about their lives, clueless. People who, like me, might have always been haunted by a feeling of otherness, of not quite belonging, and the sense that there was something wrong, something secret. So there would be more to come. I knew Michael was right, that this wouldn't be the end of the story, but it didn't set my mind at ease. My biological father had made it clear that he was done with me. The possibility of half-siblings conceived through artificial insemination was bizarre and felt somehow less than human, as if we had been a litter of kittens, each placed with a different owner. A few days earlier, a high school friend had sent a photo she'd found of me dancing at a 16th birthday party. I took in my pudgy teenage face, my hair pulled back in a bandana, my eyes half closed in a self-conscious attempt to look cool and sexy. I remembered the disorder in my mind, my intense desire to please, my lack of any clear sense of myself. This is true of many teenagers, of course, but my relationship to my own identity was even murkier. That girl did not know who her father was. She was wrapped in a thick cocoon of the deepest sort of misinformation. She, quite literally, did not know where she came from. Would I ever again look at a photograph of myself, or my father, or my mother, without the eerie sense that our lives together had from the start been built on a lie? Would I ever look at myself and not see Ben Walden reflected back at me? Late that night, half drunk, exhausted, I created a new file on my computer titled Imaginary Responses. In the weeks to come, each time I felt compelled to write to Ben, instead I would open the file and draft a note I knew I would never send. Imaginary Response 1. "Ben, for the rest of my life, when I look in the mirror, I will see your face. As I'm sure you've noted, the resemblance is more than striking. It would have been nice to have felt better about the face staring back at me. I wasn't asking for much, and I gave you every assurance of privacy. I would have happily signed a waiver or a release if that would have made you feel better. For you to be unwilling to grant me these two small favors, which would make a real difference in my life moving forward, is incomprehensible to me." Imaginary Response 2. "Dear Ben, in one of my favorite short stories, Delmore Schwartz's In Dreams Become Responsibilities, written on the eve of his 21st birthday, A secondary character addresses the narrator. You will find that out soon enough. Everything you do matters too much. I would have thought that as a person whose focus is on medical ethics, you would have considered the ethics of the situation we find ourselves in, and not fallen back on youth, or how so many others were doing it, or a paper you signed at an institute promising privacy. This is a moral, ethical, human issue, and though I'm sure you have your reasons and can justify them to yourself, you're doing something cruel and inhumane and not taking responsibility for something you in fact did. Imaginary Response 3. Dear Ben Walden, I have begun referring to you in my head as Ben Walden, not Ben, not my biological father, which is a mouthful. I need a way of thinking of you as the man who gave me life but isn't willing to meet me for a cup of coffee. I feel it's important that I clarify one thing. It seems your greatest concern is your privacy. You've used that word in every single communication. Donating for a period of time is surely what you're most concerned about. I imagine you're worried that I'm at the lead of a long parade of offspring who will show up unannounced at your doorstep, which, of course, is not my problem. I also imagine that you were worried, had you been willing to meet me, that I might have, say, Oprah jump out of the bushes with a camera crew. I wanted to reassure you that I would never have done such a thing, that my interest was at its deepest level, in understanding where I come from, so that I might be able to live the rest of my life in peace. Chapter 33. The strangest summer of my life was coming to an end, though there were no signs that fall would be any less strange. Michael, Jacob, and I were getting ready for our annual trip to Provincetown on the tip of Cape Cod, to the artist's colony where I taught each August. I tried to focus on the ordinary, grounding details of daily life. There were lists to be made, of course, always lists to be made, as if writing items in neat vertical rows might stave off randomness and chaos. I had a pile of student work to read, not to mention the usual chores before leaving home. Bills to be paid, the refrigerator to be cleaned out, our dogs to be taken to the kennel. I reveled in the normalcy, but as I went through the motions, was in me a pendulum continued to swing back and forth. On one side was Ben Walden, the fact of him, of his existence in the world. And on the other side was the tangled story of my parents and my continued, fervent desire to believe that they hadn't betrayed me. I tried with varying degrees of success to push thoughts of Ben to the side and to trust Michael's certainty that more would be revealed. I wrote my imaginary responses, and I continued to read books about the practice and history of donor insemination, searching for clues, as if there might be a case study in which I would recognize my parents and all would be revealed. I combed the internet for mentions of Edmund Farris, and finally I stumbled on a lead. A graduate student who was helping me with research was given the name of a doctor who had begun his career at Penn and remembered the Farris Institute. A few days before our trip to Provincetown, I made a phone date with Dr. Alan de Chernay. I was in New York that afternoon for meetings and didn't want to speak to the elderly doctor from a noisy street corner or restaurant. I got in touch with a friend, a boutique owner, and asked if I could hole myself up in the back room of her shop for an hour. Surrounded by racks of jackets and piles of designer jeans, I opened my notebook and dialed de Chernay. After I introduced myself and explained the nature of my interest in Edmund Farris and the Farris Institute, there was a brief pause on the other end of the phone. "It's unbelievable that you found me," he finally said. "I am probably the only person alive who can tell you about Farris." He proceeded to provide me with some background. From 1970 to 1974, de Chernay had been a medical resident at Penn, where the strong suit in OBGYN was infertility. A friend of his who ran the chemistry lab had lost a toddler in a tragic accident, and he and his wife were desperate to get pregnant again, but had been unable to conceive until they found Edmund Farris. "Were lots of people at Penn aware of Farris?" I asked de Chernay. "I never knew a doctor who knew him, nor a patient who knew him," he responded. He was off in his own little clinic. As I pondered how this could have been possible, de Tournay added a detail. Farris was an outlaw, he said. He was practicing medicine without a license. My mother in the car, the darkness, the inky black of the Hudson River, the graceful arc of lights illuminating the George Washington Bridge. Institute, Philadelphia, your father, slow sperm, brilliant doctor. How did I know to commit her words to memory? Not a pretty story. So Farris had been no brand name. My parents had gone to a back-alley rogue scientist who threw out the rulebook and got the job done. My parents were law-abiding people. What Farris was doing was lawless. How desperate must they have been as they made those trips to Philadelphia? Farris had a gimmick, de Tournay went on. He had a way of measuring LH, so he could tell when women were ovulating. The gimmick he had wasn't fraudulent. He was onto something. I thought of the story the endocrinologist Leonard Hayflick had told me about the white rats being injected with the urine of hopeful women. This was Farris's gimmick. The chemistry part was real, de Tournay went on. Years later, in 1976, it became common practice to use the LH test to time ovulation. How could Farris have established his own clinic on the campus of Penn when he wasn't an MD? How did he advertise in the medical school for donors? He pioneered a fertility test that in time became the gold standard, for which he never got the credit. Why was he now no more than a footnote in the history of reproductive medicine in this country? But what rose to the top of all those questions was only this. What happened once my parents had committed to Farris's back-alley operation? What would he have told them? Was it possible that de Tournay could shed any light on an intimate conversation at which he wasn't present? What I'm most interested in, I said, is what my parents knew. Well, they certainly would have mixed your father's sperm with donor sperm, he responded matter-of-factly. This was the practice. And they, my parents, would have been told it was happening? My friend's tiny toy poodle skittered into the back room. In a way, yes and no. What do you mean? What language would have been used? What words? I was talking fast now, rushing, impatient. Yes and no? I couldn't live with yes and no. Your parents would have been told it was a treatment. A treatment. Everything slowed down. Such an innocuous word. A gentle word. A medical word. A word that could mean absolutely anything. A treatment for your father's low sperm count, de Tournay continued. They would have been told that the treatment would help the husband's sperm. Alone in the dim back room, I felt something new. I closed my eyes and saw my hopeful parents sitting across the desk from Edmund Farris, after 3, 4, 5 inseminations with only my father's sperm, after 3, 4 miscarriages. Time was running out. Pru ou revu. My educated parents, who knew something about biology, making a dark and complicated decision to hear only what they wanted to hear and to believe only what they longed to believe. By the time I finished my training in the mid-1970s, de Tournay said, it was considered passé. What was considered passé, I asked. The mixing of sperm, calling it a treatment? All of it, de Tournay replied. They eventually stopped mixing sperm because it didn't help, and it gave people a false sense of security. I thought it was okay, though, he added. Why, I asked. Why did you think it was okay? I mean, it all worked out. Your father never knew. There it was, 4 little words. Your father never knew. I tried to take a deep breath. There always would have been a question mark, de Tournay said. That was the whole point, to protect the father. But what about protecting the child, I asked. I mean, it didn't entirely work out. Because now I know. Precisely, de Tournay said. He sounded almost rueful. Now there are no more secrets. Chapter 34. Ben had mentioned his children in most of his correspondence with me. It was clear that he had shared the outlines of the situation. There it was again, that word, situation. Had he told them my name? He seemed to be trying to control things. If he had shared my name, then my half-siblings would be able to look me up. They could get in touch with me. They could do their own genetic testing if they so desired. I had no way of knowing what was going on the other side of the country. But what I could do was continue to gather information, which allowed me to feel some semblance of control as well. I had a half-sister and two half-brothers. I had spent 54 years thinking Susie was my half-sister, so the idea of a sister wasn't foreign to me. But the concept of a half-brother was new territory. Both half-brothers were married with a couple of kids. I had already ascertained that one was an attorney, and the other worked in the tech industry. I found my half-sister on Facebook and Twitter. There we both floated, digital ghosts, our two avatars among millions of avatars populating a universe made of pixels and bits that connected me to the Waldens and the Waldens to me, enabling not only the swiftness of discovery, but discovery itself. Emily Walden had inherited her Brazilian mother's jet-black hair and dark eyes, but still, I could see the resemblance between us. We had the same high forehead, the same proportion to our features. The details available about Emily made me think that we might easily be friends. Certainly, we had a lot in common. We had both graduated from women's colleges. Her politics were liberal. She worked for a philanthropic foundation. On Twitter, she followed many of the same people I did. Though she wasn't particularly active on social media, it was still possible to paint a picture, however faint, of her life. She was married and had two kids, a girl and a boy. The boy looked to be the same age as Jacob. Michael was able to track traffic on my website and had statistics that told him how many people were on my website at any given time, how long they lingered on certain pages, and where they were from. In the weeks following Ben's final communication, there was an unusual spike of visitors from Portland, Oregon. Was it a coincidence that several of them spent hours reading deep into my old essays and interviews, particularly those that related to family? Or that quite a few people went back to the beginning of my decade-old blog to read every post? At times I thought maybe we were imagining things. Maybe I just had some dedicated readers in Portland. But at other times I envisioned us, Ben's family and mine, all of us reading, searching, digging towards some sense of one another and of this unexpected turn our lives had taken. Perhaps as I was watching YouTube videos of Santa and grandchildren's excursions to SeaWorld, they were reading essays about my father's time with the Lubavitcher Rebbe or my spiritual journey away from my strict religious upbringing. We were packing up the car for our trip to Provincetown when I heard the sound of Michael's feet on the stairs. It was the sound of news. I was storing my power cords and computer in their carrying bag when he stepped into my office, open laptop in hand. He didn't look stricken the way he had at the beginning of the summer, his screen displaying the DNA results that would change my life. This time, he looked triumphant. "Emily just followed you on Twitter," he said. He showed me her name atop a list of my newest followers. Emily Walden. There she was. I felt a strange and instant comfort. She did know about me. She did. And she was reaching out. The three of us piled into our packed-to-the-gills car and began the long drive to Provincetown. I kept my phone in my lap, refreshing Twitter again and again to see if perhaps Emily Walden had thought better of it and unfollowed me. But there she continued to be. My thumb hovered over her avatar, a bitmoji of a dark-haired, apple-cheeked woman. It took 2 days for me to follow her back. I was afraid of seeming too jumpy, too eager, though of course I was both. Finally, early one morning, as I sat in the sun-drenched kitchen of our cottage at the Arts Center, I touched follow on my phone's screen. I saw it, a vision, two half-sisters who had never known of one another's existence, sending the most modern version of a smoke signal, each from her own coast. "I see you. I see you too." Chapter 35. Later, I will become a student of trauma. I will read deeply on the subject as a way of understanding the two opposite poles of my own history, the trauma my parents must have experienced in order to have made a decision so painful that it was buried at the moment it was made, and the trauma of my discovery of that decision more than half a century later. Anything was capable of setting it off. A guest at a party in my home admired the sepia photograph of the small boy in his bowler hat. "Who's that?" The answer I had always given was no longer true. Or a doctor's appointment at which I was asked to update my medical history. How could I explain that my father was no longer deceased? While having my vision checked, I let my longtime ophthalmologist know that I am genetically predisposed to a rare eye condition. "Nothing to worry about," Bennett said. "It would be reasonable to be followed." It is the nature of trauma that when left untreated, it deepens over time. I had experienced trauma over the years and had developed ways of dealing with it. I meditated each morning. I had a decades-long yoga practice. I had suffered other traumas, my parents' car accident, Jacob's childhood illness, and had come out the other side eventually. What I didn't understand was that as terrible as these were, they were singular incidents. The car crash. The diagnosis. In the aftermath, what was left to be dealt with was the grief, the anxiety. But this, the discovery that I wasn't who I had believed myself to be all my life, that my parents had on some level, no matter how subtle, made the choice to keep the truth of my identity from me, this was no singular incident. It wasn't something outside myself to be held to the light and examined and finally understood. It was inseparable from myself. It was myself. The boa constrictor had begun to metabolize the elephant. I began to visualize my parents' choices on a continuum, like weights on a scale. On one end, there was absolute lack of knowledge. But my desperate parents, struggling to have a child, had gone to a lawless institute near the campus of Penn to see a mad scientist known specifically for donor insemination. Increasingly, absolute lack of knowledge had begun to seem like my own self-protective fantasy. Everyone seemed to be telling me that my parents had possessed some level of knowledge. Wendy Kramer, Leonard Hayflick, Alan DeCherney, Rabbi Lookstein, Aunt Shirley, all of them had gently, or not so gently, let me know that there was agency. My parents had made a decision, and no matter how difficult or painful, I had to open the door to the likelihood that they had some awareness. The weights inched further over to conscious knowledge with each passing week. Their trauma became mine, had always been mine. It was my inheritance, my lot. My parents' tortured pact of secrecy was as much a part of me as the genes that had been passed down by my mother and Ben Walden. It was another facet of the whole picture. It felt as if I had only ever been able to see in two dimensions, and now I had been handed a pair of 3D glasses. The clarity was both liberating and devastating. I listened over and over again to the interview with the psychiatrist Bessel van der Kolk, which I had noted on that early index card. "The nature of trauma," van der Kolk had said, "is that you have no recollection of it as a story. The nature of traumatic experience is that the brain doesn't allow a story to be created." I grew up to become a storyteller. I moved from fiction to memoir, writing 1, 2, 3, 4, now 5 memoirs. I captured my life and the life of my family between the pages of book after book and thought, "There, that's it. Now I understand." I dug until my shovel hit rock. Sometimes, people suggested that I must have an amazing memory, that surely I must recall so many scenes, moments, sensory details from my early years. But the truth is that I have a terrible memory. I struggled to access any of my childhood or even my teenage years. I had no recollection of it as a story. And so I followed my own line of words to see where it would lead me. I understood that there were layers, striations of consciousness, inaccessible through analysis or intellect. Only in a state of half-dreaming could I begin, and then only barely, to touch the truth. I am the black box, discovered years, many years after the crash. The pilots, the crew, the passengers have long been committed to the sea. Nothing is left of them. fathoms deep, I have spent my life transmitting the faintest signal. Over here, over here. I have settled upon the ocean floor. I am also the diver who has discovered the black box. What's this? I have been looking for it all my life without knowing it existed. Now I hold it in my hands. It may or may not contain clues. It is a witness to a history it recorded but did not see. What went on in that plane? Why did it fall from the sky? Chapter 36. Our week in Provincetown, usually a fun time for my family, was instead a struggle. Each morning I met with my class around a workshop table in a high-ceilinged studio to discuss their stories. The subject matter, as is often the case in a creative nonfiction class, was thorny and painful. Addiction, suicide, grief, estrangement, abuse. The difficult passages of people's lives and the desire to wrest meaning from those passages never fail to move me. As a teacher, I am accustomed to being able to hold my students' stories with both rigor and care. I am usually able to leave myself and my own troubles behind when I teach. But during this particular week, I felt unsteady. In a journal I had kept in my early 20s, I berated myself, just a short while after my father had died, for still being in the thick of grief. As a grown woman, stumbling across that journal entry, I wanted to reach back and let that young lost girl know it was okay. I wanted to tell her that grief, particularly the phenomenon known as complicated grief, runs its own course in its own time. But it was hard for me to allow myself that same compassion now. I tried to tuck my sorrow away each day as I taught, went to the beach, biked around town, ate lobster rolls on Commercial Street with Michael and Jacob. But when I awoke each morning, it was to the wallop of shock and the remembering all over again as if for the first time. All the while, as I began to reassemble and re-understand the childhood I could hardly remember, Ben Walden was never far from my mind. Friends kept sending me articles about donor-conceived people discovering half-siblings or searching for biological fathers. I wondered if Ben was also reading and thinking about any of this, or whether he had moved on. Was he at all tortured by the idea that he had a biological child, or likely multiple biological children, wandering the earth? That his actions had living consequences? I also wondered if his daughter knew that he had written me a letter severing our communication. Would Emily have told him that she followed me on Twitter? Was the Walden family sitting around the dinner table discussing the matter of me? Finally, sunburned, sticky, tired, our skin salty, sand covering the floor of our car, we began our trek home. I closed my eyes as Michael navigated vacation traffic. I was exhausted from my week of making room for other people's stories when I hardly had the space for my own. In the years we'd been coming to Provincetown, we'd established a routine to break up the long, monotonous ride. We stopped at a roadside tourist attraction, Arnold's Lobster and Clam Bar, and gorged on towering trays of fried clams and onion rings, washed down with cold soda. This annual trip spelled end of summer for our family. Jacob would be getting ready to start his junior year of high school. Michael and I, too, were in back-to-school mode. I was busy with plans for my upcoming book, and Michael was in the throes of putting together a new film. We had plenty going on, but no matter what was happening in our daily lives, my mind continued to leap back to only one story, and it seemed like it would be that way forever. We had stopped for gas somewhere along the Mid-Cape Highway when I dug into my purse for my phone and saw, amid announcements of sales and political entreaties, Ben Walden's name. His subject line read, "Second Thoughts." I said nothing. Jacob was in the back seat, listening to music on his headphones. Michael was inside the rest stop. I spent a long moment looking at the subject of the email before I opened it. "Second Thoughts." Dear Danny, my wife Pilar and I will be flying to Newark on Monday, October 10th, and will be in Paramus for a few days in order to be with an ill friend. We'll then be driving to Philadelphia for a class reunion and to visit my sister there. I have been having second thoughts about meeting with you. It may well be the right thing for both of us to bring more of a sense of reality to our human connection. I know your schedule is busy, but would it be possible to meet with us for lunch somewhere within a 20-minute drive from Paramus. Either Tuesday the 11th or Wednesday the 12th would work. Or if you happen to be in the Philadelphia area, we could work something out later in the week. I apologize for wavering on the idea of meeting. I hope that you are still interested and that the timing works. Your husband, of course, is more than welcome to join us. Best regards, Ben. Chapter 37. From the time I was a child, I thought of the month of September also as the month of Elul, the last month of the Jewish calendar leading to the high holidays. Elul is meant to be a period of reckoning with oneself in preparation for Rosh Hashanah, when God opens the book of life and judges each one of us. How have we sinned? How might we repent? Following Elul are the days of awe, the 10-day stretch between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, a period of intense transformation fraught with meaning and dread. On Erev Yom Kippur, God gathers the great court to determine our fate, and on Yom Kippur, the book of life is sealed for the coming year. In synagogue, we list our sins, pounding our chests above our hearts. For the sin we have committed before you by false denial and lying. For the sin we have committed before you by a confused heart. Some of my clearest memories of my father are of praying with him. As a young girl, I was allowed to sit next to him in shul, and I could hear the way his body relaxed when he davened, the way his voice became stronger and fuller within the plaintive melodies of the Hebrew liturgy. The synagogue was his home. When he shook his tallis from its velvet pouch and wrapped it around his shoulders, he became larger, almost mystical. Here in shul, prayer was our secret language, our way of connecting. We had the choreography down. We knew just what to do. Here we stand, here we sit, here we sway, here we close our siddurs, here we sing Ein Keloheinu, here we kiss each other's cheeks and say Good Shabbos. What thoughts ran through my father's mind as he listed those sins, his little girl beside him? Was he confused? Did he feel he had lied? It was a solemn undertaking, this business of reckoning. The Sunday